You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although he was born profoundly deaf, Josh Swiller was raised in the mainstream and went to Africa to escape the difficulty of not fully belonging to the deaf community or the hearing one. In Zambia, the Peace Corps trained him to dig wells. But getting the work done was not a simple task, and he realized that his main job was cultural exchange and survival. Josh Swiller's new memoir, The Unheard, tells of his time in rural Africa and his attempts to improve life there. It's published by Holt, and I'm pleased that it has brought Mr. Swiller to my show today. Hello.
Hi. Nice to be here.
So you didn't go to school with deaf children?
No, I was mainstreamed, which means I was I got hearing aids very young and had speech pathology, learned to speak every day after school for about 10 years.
You had cochlear implant surgery a few years ago. So do you hear differently now than you did in the past?
Oh, totally. I do 600% better on standard hearing tests than I've ever done in my life. Cochlear implants, I mean, I have a computer implanted in my skull. I don't hear through my ears anymore, and it works incredibly well.
But for a long time, you were relying on hearing aids, which are less than perfect at times. Was that a problem when you were an undergraduate at Yale?
Yes, completely. Because hearing aids, you're working with a broken system. You're going through the ear, which has problems. So as much as you're amplifying the sound, it just you don't get it all. And then at Yale...
And you're also hearing other sounds as well. You're hearing the car horn down the street, much louder than I would hear it.
Yes. And you're also hearing, you know, a lot of the professors at Yale, I remember, had very strong foreign accents and very thick beards. And so it was a lot of... just sounded like mumbling and growling.
Because you also relied on looking at their lips. Yeah. To some degree, lip reading augments the hearing aid.
Yes, lip reading is very important. But the mortal enemies of like the deaf child are like people with beards, people who talk through a smile, people who like talk while facing the blackboard instead of facing you, and of course, Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan, why Bob Dylan?
Bob Dylan, I don't think there's a deaf person alive who can understand a word that man is singing.
Well, I have a beard and I'm smiling. I hope this isn't causing you too much trouble. You also went to Gallaudet, the National University for the Deaf. Did you know how to sign at that point?
No, I learned there. And I was hoping when I got there to... sort of find a place past these frustrations of not feeling able to fit in. And unfortunately, I found that to the students there, I was a hearing person. Just as to the hearing person growing up, I was deaf.
Because there's been a heated debate at Gallaudet over whether deaf people should try to speak or create a unique community that only communicates through sign language.
This is true. It's true. And it's really at a point now with... cochlear implants getting more and more support and being more widespread where people just don't know what's going to happen to the deaf community.
Well, there were people at Gallaudet who were opposed to cochlear implants because they feel that it kind of destroys the special experience of people who can't hear.
That's true, too. It's hard to say. I mean, you can't stop technology.
So you felt like an outsider.
I did. I felt like an outsider growing up. Hearing, I felt like an outsider at Gallaudet, and so with my, you know, 21-year-old idealism, I thought, I want to go someplace where I'm so far outside, where life is so intense and immediate that deafness won't matter anymore.
Had other deaf people join the Peace Corps?
They do. Most, the Peace Corps has a program for signing deaf people in Kenya. I didn't go through that program. My sign wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. So I went through a regular hearing volunteer.
But you did have special training.
Well, when we got to the country, and I was in Zambia, and when we got there, we had 3 months of language training and training in how to dig wells. And interestingly enough, in the language training, I learned the language just about as well as any of the other volunteers, because I was so used to paying attention when people talked. I was so used to asking people to repeat themselves. And I was used to misunderstanding someone, saying something completely inappropriate, and then being like, yeah, whatever.
But also because you were bilingual to some degree, even if American Sign was the second language and you weren't as proficient as you might have wanted to be. You happened to find a school for deaf children in the city where you were being trained.
I did. That was one of my first experiences there in Africa. I found a school for the deaf in the city of my training, and that was an eye-opener because my experience of deafness was either Gallaudet, you know, where there was this wonderful community, or mainstream, where you can have a lot of opportunities. And then the deaf children in Africa, they were just being taught to push a broom or to wipe the blackboards. That was it.
And you're being asked to dig wells was not similar to that?
Similar in what way?
Well, it's more of a physical thing than an intellectual thing.
Well, digging wells, you know, that's what I thought when I got there. I thought digging a well, okay, you get a bunch of shovels, you get a bunch of guys, and you go out to the field. But that doesn't work. It's not that, actually. You want the community to really be involved and invested, or otherwise it's just, you know, like Great White Father giving something else.
Well, that was a big problem all along. This book is as much about how cultures really have problems communicating. It doesn't matter whether you're deaf or have any other kinds of problems. You just have problems because you come out of a different world. They see the world differently than you do.
Mm-hmm.
You were sent to live in a town called Manunga.
Yes.
For 2 years. Mm-hmm. So how did the villagers treat you? You were the first white person they'd seen, weren't you?
Yes. I mean, that fact alone kind of eliminated the fact that I was deaf. The fact that I was a Caucasian just blew them away. And so maybe they thought every white person wears these big, weird earrings and says what a lot. And,
although there was a time when your hearing aids were stolen and they had problems with communicating that to the police.
Yeah, I kind of went through just about every experience you can have out there. It still amazes me sometimes. I saw, you know, mobs go wild and beat people to death. I saw all kinds of disease and witchcraft. And sometimes I had my hearing aid stolen.
My guest is Josh Swiller, who's written a memoir of deafness in Africa called The Unheard. It is published by Holt. Well, you had to, since you were going to be digging wells, you really had to figure out how to mobilize people. So you also had to learn about village politics, didn't you?
I did. And that's where I had a problem. See, they had something called snake in the grass. And they thought that when you are trying to get something from someone, especially someone of higher status, you don't confront them directly. You go, like, you slip around, you flatter them, you be very polite. And I wasn't used to that way. I came from the school of having three brothers who are bigger than me. And when I wanted something, I had to strike fast and strike hard. So that just created problems.
So you were helped to some degree because you established a friendship with a man named Augustine Jere.
Yes.
And he did he understand that you were different and you wouldn't just you weren't aware of some of the more subtle things, the more diplomatic things that were necessary?
Yeah, he was one of the most remarkable men I've ever met in my life. And you asked if he understood if I was different. What I think about is he understood that we were the same and that I wasn't strange foreigner, but I was just a person like him who wanted to do the right thing and had, you know, hurts and worries and complaints and everything. I mean, he was amazing. In this village in the middle of nowhere, he was a Shakespeare buff, he was a chess fanatic, and his heart was always in the right place, which is hard when there's so much suffering all around you.
You say that at first most Peace Corps volunteers think that they're meant to do a specific job, and you had tried to take that seriously. It was about digging wells. But then you came to a different conclusion as to what the Peace Corps was really about.
Yeah. I mean, if the Peace Corps was really about digging wells, then they could have given me a truck with a borehole well truck, and I could have, you know, in $1 million, excuse me, I could have dug 50 wells in 2 years and taken care of the waterborne disease problems for 1 million people.
And that would have really have helped in a village like this. It was a growing village.
It would have helped, but once I left, then what? If the well broke, you know, it just sort of would have taught people to wait around for someone else to come and solve the problems.
You had a situation with a woman named Alice. what happened there? The short version.
Well, you talked about different ways of doing things culturally. That was... she was a very beautiful young woman in the village, and she came over to my hut late one night after I'd had a few too many glasses of banana wine. And she came over for the night, and the next morning her father sued me for defiling a virgin, for giving her white man diseases, and for making her pregnant. None of which happened, but that led to a very tense trial.
Well, you later learned that she was engaged to be married, probably was already pregnant, but obviously her father was playing the system to get money from you. He was asking you for a lot of money. Do you think you should have been aware of how the locals felt about the importance of virginity and their attitude toward casual sex?
Hey, I had a lot of banana wine. All that goes out the window. I mean, yeah, I try to be very sensitive to what was going on. But, you know, you also have to understand, you know, I was just a young man in a village, days travel away from phones, electricity, running roads.
And she had been sent in to be very seductive.
Excuse me, I what?
She had been sent in to be seductive.
Yes, and she succeeded. So...
You mentioned a violent incident that took place on Christmas Eve, and that you watched a crowd descend upon a man who was accused of murder. He probably hadn't really committed a murder. They killed his friend first and then got him, and there was almost a bloodlust. Was this something that would happen a lot, or was this a unique situation?
You know what I compare it to is... when you read about the Wild West and you hear how, like, if someone stole one head of cattle, they would get a posse and go and string them up and kill them. And that's how they kept justice. They didn't wait for the police. They just had this immediate, extreme retribution.
A boy, in fact, was caught stealing a fish and his leg was cut off.
Yes. So wow. The same thing.
How did you work that out for yourself?
I'm still working it out, you could say. I mean, to see things like that, at least for me, makes me question every day, you know, what is my purpose? What can I do to improve things?
That's why you moved to a Zen center after you left Africa?
I did. I moved there. Seen so many things in Africa that I just couldn't get my mind around. And, you know, more than just, like, not being able to dig wells, the hardest thing about being in Africa was just being so inefficient and not being able to, like, really help with the great problems they have there.
Well, the book opens with you and Jerry hiding from an angry mob that wants to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of those problems with cultural differences and misunderstandings?
Yeah, to put it mildly. Jerry and I rubbed some people the wrong way. And, you know, it was a lot like, it was almost like the mafia ran the town. And we just didn't get along with them.
Did you get in trouble with the Peace Corps? This was in your attempt to build a new clinic, and everything seems to have gone wrong. I don't want to tell the whole story because mm-hmm. that's a centerpiece of the book. But you were breaking Peace Corps rules at the same time that you were also breaking the rules of the town.
You know, Peace Corps, they just drove me up in a big van, dropped me off with a 2-year supply of underwear and hearing aid batteries, and they were pretty much like, good luck. So they didn't really ask too many questions.
Your website mentions that you're interested in starting a nonprofit company to help deaf people in Zambia. Is that project underway?
Yes, it is. My website is joshswiller.com, joshswiller.com. And a lot of people read the book and get interested in doing more for the disabled children in Africa. And so I've made a list of organizations that are doing great work there. And I'm trying to working on starting up my own nonprofit.
And you've worked at many interesting jobs since your return from Africa. Forest ranger, raw food chef, sheepskin slipper salesman.
Hey, I was good at that. What are you doing now? Excuse me?
What are you doing now?
Now I'm a hospice social worker at a hospice in Brooklyn.
And you wrote this book.
And I wrote this book.
Are you hoping to write more?
I am, very much so.
I'll bet you there's a novel that can grow out of this experience as well.
I hope so. But right now I'm just going around telling people about this story because I think it's an important one. I think it's one that can teach people something. I mean, I hope it taught me something.
Josh Swiller's book, The Unheard, A Memoir of Deafness and Africa, is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Josh Swiller will be speaking and signing books tomorrow night in New Paltz. For more information about this and his other upcoming events, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Up next, Philip Winslow, who spent almost 3 years in the West Bank during the Second Intifada. He'll be explaining how the violence, humiliation, and victimization is felt on both sides of the conflict. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also heard on satellite.